A thing that looks like a police box standing in a junkyard. It can move anywhere.
Haven, concentrate on Sin. Give priority to the detectors and the navigation systems.
There is a corridor. And the corridor is time. It surrounds all things.
On display, I eventually had to go down to the cellar.
That's the display department.
With a torch.
The lights are probably gone.
So had the stairs.
Yours is number 6.
I am not a number. I am a person.
Welcome to British Invaders, episode 267. This is the podcast all about British science fiction television, and this time we are continuing our discussion about Stingray. This is Brian from Canada.
And this is Eamon from England. Hello again. Gerry Anderson and his wonderful world of supermarionation that we make a visit to usually once a year. And this is a show from 1964 and 1965. It's an ITV show, of course. We have a total of 39 25-minute episodes. And the fabulous machine this time is Stingray, a submarine that leads the defense against a variety of undersea threats on humanity. It's exciting stuff, Brian.
Yes, absolutely. And these are the marionette puppets with the large-scaled heads compared to the bodies at this point in their run. And they were indeed lip-synced, so the lips would move along with the speech. And they had, in this one, for the first time, different heads they could swap in. So you had some different facial expressions that the characters could have. And this was the first of the Super Marionation shows to be in color. In fact, it was shot in what they called Vidicolor.
Yes, any color film technology seemed to have a special name back then, I think, Brian. I think it's possibly one they just came up with, but yeah, it looks great anyway.
Yes, as early as 1964 for television in the UK, having color productions was unusual. Most shows were not doing that at that point. And certainly very few children's shows would be in color in the UK in 1964.
Cutting edge stuff from the Anderson team. And like you said in the last episode, Brian, I do like how in the opening, or at least in the first block of episodes, we get a transition from black and white, zooming in on the screen saying filmed in Vidicolor, and then pulling out to see that that's actually on a screen in Commander Shaw's Marineville base. Great stuff.
Yes, for sure. So getting into a little bit more detail on some of the story elements that we have in Stingray, we learn that Marina, this undersea woman who is unable to speak, who has joined up with the crew. We learn that she is actually very loyal to WASP, their organization. That's the World Aquanaut Security Patrol. And Marina's ability to breathe underwater and to swim deep underwater without any equipment required comes into play quite a number of times.
Yes, she is a useful member of the crew, and of course the third member of the love triangle with Captain Troy Tempest and Atlanta. And of course, as we go on through the various episodes, each one with their own dramatic scenario, we'll find out various bits and pieces. So as we said last time, we do find out how Commander Shaw ended up in a hover chair because of his disability that he acquired in service. And of course, as we've said, it's a 60s show, so there is some espionage and spy-fi in there. So this time we have the land-based Agent X-20 or X-20. The puppet looks like the actor Claude Rains, but sounds like the actor Peter Lorre. And he is often working for King Titan and trying to sabotage or reveal plans of Stingray and the fabulous base of Marineville and its defences.
Yes, that's Robert Easton doing a Peter Lorre style voice there. They certainly didn't have Peter Lorre himself working on this.
What a show that would have been. I'll mention another episode. You know, it's a water-based show. So they decided at one point to transport Stingray and her crew to Loch Ness to investigate the Loch Ness monster. And we do indeed get a monster, which is a fun episode. I'm sure if you know the Anderson sort of universe, you can perhaps figure out what sort of monster it's going to turn out to be. But yeah, fun in Scotland, and phones perhaps getting touches of his own Scottish ancestry as well.
Yes, some interesting and somewhat different things in that one for sure. We also have the indignity of Stingray being shrunk to the size of a toy and being placed in a fish tank. So we have some juggling around of things with scale. Not necessarily with scales, although this is underwater, but certainly with scale in that episode that does some odd stuff that's kind of fun too.
Yes, another 60s theme, miniaturization. Yeah. Great fun. And of course, along the way, we'll return from time to time to the threat of the Aquaphibians, King Titan, and their Terrorfish submarines, which are sort of deadly submarines, which look like, I suppose they're sort of modelled on a piranha fish sort of design, Brian, and they'll pursue Stingray and come into combat against Stingray at various times.
Yes, I'm not sure that that design is the most hydrodynamic of craft, but it's certainly an interesting one that looks very different on screen.
Yeah, Stingray looks very streamlined, the Terrorfish less so, but it does look great. And interestingly, you know, as I said before, when I recalled this series, I thought that the battle between the forces of Marineville and the Aquaphibians made up most of the storyline of Stingray. But actually, as I was rewatching it, I was surprised, firstly, by how many other underwater races there are and how many other scenarios Stingray got called to investigate or combat. We'll talk about that when we get to our own views as to whether it would have been a different show. But anyway, we'll come back to that in a moment.
We also, as we mentioned last time, have unusually some romantic plot lines to this, which sort of comes up a number of times.
Yes, it does bump up the love angle in this show. So the Troy, Atlanta and Marina triangle gets quite a lot of time in various episodes. Who will Troy fall for? And we do see Atlanta and Marina sort of swooning over him, although occasionally they're distracted by other members of the cast. It's interesting, I think, that Lois Maxwell is voicing Atlanta as a, the commander's lieutenant, who also has a sort of possibly unrequited love interest in the main hero. But yeah, and it, of course, it allows for a number of costume changes. We'll see Atlanta and Marina in various wonderfully designed evening gowns. We'll see them standing around pianos, which seem to be a constant in the Anderson world, with having one of the puppets sitting at the piano. There's a variety of evening work and clubs and so on that they go to, Brian.
Yes, absolutely. And we have fun and games with movie stars and pop stars showing up. That, you know, they love to sort of create their own little pop culture world of, you know, movie stars and that sort of thing that show up in these.
Yeah, you're probably getting the impression, if you've never seen Stingray, but that this is a very 60s show, I think, Brian. There's a lot of 60s themes to it.
Yeah, for sure. And earlier in Fireball XL5, there was something of a romantic sense between Steve Zodiac and Venus, Dr. Venus, but it was not something that you saw much of in the Super Marionation shows. And in this one, you saw a lot more of it than you did in Fireball XL5. and in many of the other shows, that really wasn't a part of it at all.
And of course, we got the end credits with a song, a love song, Marina, or Aquamarina, sung by Gary Miller, which is, you know, again, composed by Barry Gray. It's a romantic piece, supposedly with Troy Tempest singing to the lovely Marina, and of course the images of her swimming underwater. So that's an interesting take that they did at the end of the show.
Yes, that was definitely there as well. We should talk about some of the spin-offs, because there were, of course, spin-offs and side products related to this, as there always would be with one of these 1960s Super Marionation shows. The Gary Miller song, as we were mentioning, was actually a hit in 1964. To note, Gary Miller was known for a number of years earlier, The Adventures of Robin Hood theme music. He sang that as well.
I did not know that until we did this show. But yes, the voice of that Robin Hood song, tremendous.
And they did some audio releases as well, as they also did for a number of the Super Marionation shows. They did three different audio adventures that were released on EPs during the 60s. I believe when they were recording the audio for the episodes, they also recorded an extra few sessions that instead of being for episodes would be for release on record.
And I think at least two of those audio adventures are included as extras on the DVD box sets. I confess I haven't listened to them, but they are there, I noticed.
Yes, I think that's right, but it may vary from one DVD release to another, because there has been more than one and it's out in both Region 2 and Region 1. So I don't know all of the details for what a particular set might have. But of course, as always, there were toys. And you had things like Terrorfish toys and, of course, a Stingray toy.
Yes, a variety of Stingray models, friction-drive wheeled versions, toys that could actually go underwater themselves, in, you know, presumably for bath time. Action figures. There was even a Matchbox Marineville base model, not unlike, I suppose, Tracy Island for Thunderbirds. And it does indeed, judging from the pictures that I've looked at, the base sinks below the ground, the missiles come up, the hatch opens so that you can push your Stingray model through it. Fabulous stuff. You know, Gerry Anderson always knew that this the power of the sort of various paraphernalia selling onwards. So there were slide projector sets that you could buy, those little sort of viewers that you could look at various scenes from the show. There's a host of things that you could get in the 60s, and of course, still available on various internet marketplaces, and the prices will probably stagger you.
If you remember what it was like with all of the Star Wars toys in the late 70s and much of the 1980s, or if you've seen or read things about that, with the Gerry Anderson shows, it was a little bit like that. Not quite at that level, but it was a little bit reminiscent of that.
Yes, absolutely. We should mention that there were, of course, Stingray comics, which appeared in TV 21 comic. And we have done episodes about Gerry Anderson comics, which you can find if you put in Anderson in the search box on BritishInvaders.com. So you can go back and listen to those.
That included a memorable crossover comic that included Stingray things alongside with Captain Scarlet and Fireball XL5 and more.
Yes, the Anderson universe. As often happened with Gerry Anderson shows, some of them were repackaged and edited together into a sort of feature-length Stingray film, which was broadcast particularly on some American channels. And of course, perhaps not surprisingly, it was picked up and used as one of the episodes for Mystery Science Theater 3000, which I understand was an enormously popular way of looking at some of these older science fiction shows and films with a certain humorous angle to them, I think, Brian.
Yes, with sort of mocking commentary on various things. It still has a fan base and a cult following to this day, and there are still things based on that being done now. Stingray was repeated on ITV in 1988, and on BBC Two in 1992, and on one of the Sky channels in 2002. It also had the US rebroadcast on the Sci-Fi network.
Yes, yeah, several repeats and rebroadcasts as a whole new generation rediscovered or discovered for the first time the Anderson shows. We've talked about this when we discussed Thunderbirds and so on.
Yeah, absolutely. And there was a reunion night episode on the BBC Four series in 2008.
Yes, they took various bits of unused footage and clips from other episodes, and Gerry Anderson himself edited it or supervised the editing of it into an episode called Reunion. Now, the Wikipedia page lists this as being available on the box set, and I confess I couldn't find it on my box set. But as you've referred to, Brian, there have been a number of issues, and I think I've got an earlier model and probably the 50th anniversary box set, which of course came out in 2015. It might be on there, I'm guessing.
Yes, that might be right. So we should get into some of our own thoughts about Stingray, what we were satisfied with and what we were not as pleased with. Eamon, what did you like about Stingray?
Well, Brian, as ever, the wonderful inventiveness and talents of the Gerry Anderson team can be in places just absolutely stunning. So, you know, I do love the setup. I love Stingray. I love the base. I love the bad guys. As you've probably guessed as we've gone along, I'm a huge fan of that opening sequence with the music, the drums, Commander Shaw's Stand By for Action, and then the, you know, the bass sinking. Troy and phones being transported into Stingray and launching. That sort of stuff is fabulous. So the setup and, you know, some of the production values of this show, absolutely great, Brian.
Okay, I will say that the model work, not so much with the puppets, but with the various models was quite neat in this. I like the design of the Stingray itself. I think it's great. And the way they did the underwater shooting was quite dynamic, and there was some neat stuff in there. So in terms of the look of it with the models and the vehicles, I quite liked it.
Yes, I think the underwater filming is tremendous, and the sequences of Stingray turning on sixpence and swooping around, plus, you know, the clever stuff they did with shining light beams through the water tank, the various bubbling effects, even having fish in there. It looks, when they do that, it looks great. Of course, with any Derek Medin's supervised show, there were explosions, several of them. You know, it must have been fun working on these shows to come in and knowing that you were going to blow stuff up again. Great stuff.
Yes, they would always blow things up, for sure. I was quite pleased to see that Commander Shaw, as this commanding officer in authority, you know, most of the time he's the top-ranking person that we see. He is confined to a wheelchair, or confined to a hover chair in this case, and it's almost never mentioned. It's just there, you see him in it all of the time, but the fact that he's disabled is never an issue and is basically not mentioned. And I thought that was really nice.
Yes. I mean, once again, Gerry Anderson being very good on sort of inclusivity, you know, portrayals of various aspects of society in his shows, always at the cutting edge doing that. So it's great stuff. The writing of the episodes, it's perhaps, I should say, it's variable. Some are more exciting and dramatic than others. I think there was a slight tendency for some of them to become a bit silly, I think, Brian.
Yeah, some of them were a little bit lightweight. You know, there was a bit of a runaround, but there wasn't much to the story there. And others had a bit more to them than that.
Yep. I suppose we have to turn to the puppets themselves, and depends what people feel about the large-headed, disproportionate puppets or marionettes. As we've discussed many a time, the heads had to be that big to fit in the lip-syncing machinery that made the mouths open and close in time with the dialogue. But they are, you know, these are the slightly clumsier end of the Gerry Anderson spectrum puppets. And the strings, certainly in some sequences, are far more visible than in later shows, I think, Brian.
Yeah, I did struggle a little with the puppetry in this one. They have sort of an odd, slightly disconcerting look to them. I think when they did Thunderbirds, which was shortly after this, I think they looked a lot better. I think the Thunderbirds puppets are much easier to watch and have a much more fluid kind of feel. It's a bit more like an animation style thing compared to this, which I find them more clunky and a little harder to watch for sure. Even, I think, compared to Fireball XL5, which was earlier, but it was in black and white, this one, they felt a little bit more disconcerting than they should, I think.
Okay. It depends what people feel about puppet shows. It can be, I think, problematical, the appearance of the puppets, as you say, slightly more clunky, slightly more strings in this show. On the positive side, I mean, I've waxed lyrical about the opening credits music and the drama of the opening of Stingray. Perhaps, you know, unfortunately, the episodes themselves don't always live up to the excitement generated by the opening. So there are some, as we've said, there are some fluffier episodes. There's various nonsense bits about pop stars and film stars, but it was the 60s, so I guess we had to accept that.
What do you think about the closing credits sequence?
Well, again, this brings me to another one of my problems with the show, because I remember from watching Stingray as a child, you know, in various repeats and so on, that the lovey-dovey stuff used to really annoy me as a kid. I didn't want all that particularly. And so the end song, the love song, you know, about Aquamarina, sung, you know, fabulously by Gary Miller, it really annoyed me. Me at the time, and I still find it slightly irksome, I'm afraid, Brian. What about you?
Yeah, I'm not a fan of that either. It's a terribly schlocky song, and it doesn't seem necessary to me. And the focus that it puts on Marina in that way just feels strangely out of place. And it highlights Marina's swimming, which just looks bizarre to me. I don't think anyone or anything swims like that.
No.
You know, she swims with her arms by her sides and just sort of flapping her feet and her hands up and down a little bit.
Yeah.
So it's a very strange swimming, which I didn't think they needed to showcase for the entire closing credit sequence in every episode. Having it show up in the episodes when it does is enough. You know, at least then it's sort of a part of what they're doing with the episode, and it looks odd, but okay, it's part of what they're doing. I think it was a little much to do it for the entire closing title sequence.
Yes, there is a remarkable contrast between the opening titles and the closing credits in terms of, you know, my excitement and interest. So, yeah, it is a problem, I suppose.
Yeah, the opening and closing, you could look at them and easily think they were for different shows.
Yeah. And, of course, I think for subsequent Super Marionation shows, they sort of turn the romantic angles down quite a bit. So it doesn't really feature very much in Thunderbirds, Captain Scarlet, and so on. I know in the reboot of, you know, the CGI reboot of Captain Scarlet, there was an implied romance between Scarlet and one of the angels. But in the originals, I think they didn't really have the love interest angle after Stingray.
Yes, I think that's probably right.
There's a theme that I've been coming back to is the war between mankind and the Aquaphibians, which, as I say, was my recollection of the show, was that was what the show was about. But watching the episodes again, I was quite surprised by how many of the episodes didn't feature Titan and the Aquaphibians and the Terrafish at all. And instead, we had this sort of endless number of aquatic races with their own various plans and plots and features. And I wonder, I mean, you know, perhaps I'm putting too much into this show, Brian, but I'm wondering if it would have been a better show if they'd featured more on the single enemy, the Aquaphibians, in the way that perhaps happened with Captain Scarlet and the Mysterons. I think, you know, that as this ongoing campaign against a threat to mankind worked better. And I wonder if Stingray might be, you know, on rewatch, a better show if they'd gone with that angle rather than just standalone Monster of the Week episodes.
Well, it may be. And I do sort of wonder if you're remembering it that way is partly because you were thinking a bit of Captain Scarlet, which very much did that.
Yeah, it may be. You know, the battle for mankind, maybe I'm thinking of Captain Scarlet. Maybe I'm just remembering, again, those absolutely superlative opening titles for Stingray, which seems to set up, you know, the war with the Aquaphibians and the Terrafish submarine.
And I think it's also probably true that Titan, as the king of the Aquaphibians, and Agent X-20 from the Aquaphibians, those are sort of the memorable villains from this. You know, I don't think we have that many really memorable villains from the other, you know, non-Aquaphibian episodes. So that may be part of it too.
Yes, I mean, you're quite right. There are only the two memorable villains. The rest of the aquatic races are just, they just seem silly. And again, the Aquaphibians themselves, when they appear, these sort of aquatic sea creatures that King Titan rules over, they were quite often, I was surprised to find that they were just played for laughs with silly voices. And I think that's one of my problems overall with Stingray. Not so much the puppetry, just the fact that it seems far too often to be slightly silly and never again lives up to the premise of the opening.
Yeah, there is certainly something to that. And I think often the storylines of the episodes tend to be a little bit light. You know, and there isn't, even in a kids' show, isn't quite as much substance as we might hope for. I found it, as pleased as I was to see Commander Shore as this disabled character being portrayed very well, I was a little bit put off by the idea of this woman who can't speak being sort of idealized as like the ideal beautiful woman as a potential romantic partner. You know, she was idealized in a way for being submissive. I think that was a little unfortunate.
Yes, looking back on it with our 21st century eyes, it does seem a bit strange. And of course, you know, Marina gets into trouble and she's a damsel in distress. So does Atlanta in at least one episode. It was a shame about Atlanta Shore because she's clearly a capable, you know, lieutenant and operative. And unfortunately, far too much of the time, she's just swooning over Troy or getting into trouble herself when, you know, it perhaps, again, our modern eyes would hope they would give her more to do in the action and adventure side of things.
Yeah, she does get a little more to do sometimes, but not often enough.
Yeah. So we've had some problems with Stingray as we go along, I suppose. Anything else you want to say about it in the pluses or minus columns, Brian?
Well, rather than dwelling on things, I think we should move on to the recommendations.
Okay, splendid. Who's going first?
Oh, I can go first. I will not be recommending this one. It is not very substantive in many ways. I found the puppets in this one harder to watch than they were in the other Super Marionation shows that I've looked at. I've looked at most of them now. And yeah, it doesn't add up to being very strong for me. So I would say, for the Super Marionation shows by the Anderson team in the 1960s, my all-time favorite is still Captain Scarlet and the Mysterons, and Stingray is near the bottom of the list for me. So I cannot recommend this one.
Okay, I'm going to put Stingray into my ranking of the Anderson Super Marionation shows. I'm going to do a top five in my best Jeff Tracy voice. You won't be surprised to hear that Secret Service has dropped out of the top five. So at five, we have Fireball XL5. Four is Joe 90. Three is Stingray. Number two is Thunderbirds. And like yourself, Brian, my favourite, number one, Captain Scarlet and the Mysterons. As regards the Stingray box set, like yourself, I think it's only for the absolute Anderson completists and fans who really want to see the whole show. You know, there's a lot of nonsense on there, unfortunately. The opening titles are still, I think, one of the most exciting things from 1960s television, but the rest of the show never quite lived up to that original excitement. I will once again, I'm going to keep pushing this £8 box set, which contains some episodes from Joe 90, Captain Scarlet and Stingray. And I think every home should have a copy just so you can get a little bit of Gerry Anderson in your life. So that's our recommendations. It's a sort of, you know, maybes along the way. But as ever, we'd like to hear from you with your own views about Stingray and the wonderful world of Fanderson and Anderson mania.
Yes, absolutely. So, in summary, Stingray introduced us to the team at the World Aquanaut Security Patrol, or WASP, and they did underwater missions with the craft Stingray, and the main crew being Troy Tempest and Phones on the earphones. And they would fight against the threats of the Aquaphibians and the evil King Titan and all sorts of other threats and things that would come up along the way. There would be a variety of espionage and different types of things that would come into play. You had at the beginning of the series the discovery of this character Marino, who is an underwater type of person who does not speak, and we have her along with Atlanta and Troy being something of a love triangle there. And it goes through with all of this in weekly adventures in classic 1960s Super Marionation style.
Great stuff, Brian. And if you'd like to win my copy of the Stingray box set, the earlier DVD box set with all the 39 episodes, then get in touch. All you have to do is email the code word I gave you in the last episode to britishinvaders@gmail.com. Send me the code word and your name, and we'll announce the winner about a week after this episode drops on the Facebook group, and I'll get in touch with you.
Aha, very good.
And of course, please come back and give us the pleasure of your company next time. We're sticking with ITV, but coming right up to 2009, a strange show that got one series called Demons, and I'll say perhaps an attempt at a British Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Brian?
That will be an interesting one to talk about for sure. So until then, you can find all of our past episodes, well over 200 of them, on BritishInvaders.com, or if you search for British Invaders on Facebook, you will find our Facebook group there, and we always have some fun discussions going on.
We do indeed. And of course, find us also at the Voice of Geeks Network, where British Invaders is one of a number of geek shows that goes out on vognetwork.com. Join the fun there as well.
Yes, absolutely. So thank you for listening. And this is Brian from Canada signing off.
Yes, thank you very much indeed. It's goodbye from Eamon in England saying, stand by for action.
Anything can happen in the next half hour.